The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Thursday, February 4th, 2016. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Here in the Western Hemisphere, the animal-borne calamity we're all frightened of is Zika. But over in Japan, they're trying to contain a different animal, zebra. A Japanese zoo held a zebra escape drill, and playing the role of a zebra was a costumed mascot who was about as threatening as the San Diego chicken. Although, when the San Diego Zoo had to put down the San Diego chicken in the name of combating West Nile, maybe that was then an occasion to rethink the poultry menace. Anyway, I know an entire industry exists around watching wacky online videos. And really, no one gives this industry credit, seriously. Like, you listen to all the Republicans, and they're all talking about how we're on the road to ruin, and things have never been worse. The next generation will have it even bleaker than the current one. We're a country in decline. What about the good things, like animal videos? Just a short while ago, if a cute animal did something, the only way to hope to see it was to be there when the animal did that thing. Then, a little bit later, there was America's Funniest Home Videos. Poodle jumps into a conga line. You get to see that. But still, it was, you know, one out of a million cute animals did we get to see. Now, in 2016, you could be sure that if an animal anywhere does anything cute, you will see that cute animal within 3 or 4 days, maybe 5, tops, if you're talking about sub-Saharan Africa animals. So that's a positive trend. Another one is razors. Now we got 5 blades. You shave your face really good. Back when America was supposedly great, it was all just 1 blade and you'd cut your face. So no one talks about that either, if we're a country in such decline. Anyway, back to the point with the wacky video thing and the animal video thing. My point is to give them credit, but also to say that there are so many wacky animal videos out there, it's really cheapened the appeal. So maybe you haven't seen this Japanese zebra escape, and it would be a shame if you didn't. First of all, don't tell the zoo employees engaged in the drill, but this isn't a real zebra. This is definitely a guy. I later found out it was a woman in a zebra suit. Because she wasn't really acting like a zebra. For instance, and if you talk to a zebra expert, they will point this out, zebras do not walk on their hind legs. And zebras do not use their front hooves to gesture expressively, which is cute, but unactual zebra-like. So at one point in this video, the zebra does an end around a bit of what seems to be expertly thought out zebra enclosure netting, but somehow the zebra outmaneuvers a worker and comes into contact with the worker, and then the worker falls down to the ground as if the zebra has mauled him to within an inch of not only his life, but a Golden Globe nomination. And then the worker gets tended to as the zebra merrily scamps along. All the workers, by the way, are wearing hazmat masks. They're taking this very seriously. I guess they believe that hazmat stands for, has zebra materialized in this part of the zoo yet? Oh, and they're also banging sticks on the ground. Zebras hate that. The video ends with the zebra surrendering himself, herself, hooves behind the head, on the zebra's knees. We can only surmise that Sal, the zebra's co-conspirator, has been shot on the tarmac after the zebra requested a plane to Cuba. Well, now that there's good relations with Cuba, maybe Montana, because Japan and Montana hate each other. And so ends the greatest depiction of a zebra in mass media since Chris Rock voiced Marty the Zebra in Madagascar. That was, of course, opposite David Schwimmer as Melman the Giraffe. We have a clip of that movie.
Juice. Juice.
This situation has gotten real bad.
Juice.
Actually, I think that may be the wrong clip. On the show today, I spiel about the value of democracy, meaning how much to pay per vote to win the election. But first, how what you taste is influenced by what you hear. And now an ad for The Gist. It's actually a job opening, and the job is producer of The Gist. Perhaps it's the case that Andrea Salenzi is ready to spread her wings. She's been mouth-fed little grubs, and now she's strong enough to fly. Maybe that's my spin. Maybe the truth is that Andrea's a fully fledged bird squawking mightily, I need to leave the nest. But come check out our nest. You know the show, or maybe you know someone who would be good at producing the show. It's someone with a bunch of experience and a lot of creativity, who is a voracious news consumer and especially enjoys or would enjoy, but please have them actually enjoy our skewed view on the news. put it this way. If you don't know what lobstar of the Antan twig means, at least get to know that phrase before you apply for the job and ask for an interview. So to find out more about the opening of Producer of The Gist, go to slate.com/thegist or our Facebook page, facebook.com/slategist. It's a nice nest, I'm telling you. In 1988, Swedish pop duo Roxette told us to listen to our heart. But perhaps if they wanted to connect to us, not through our ears and not through our emotions, but through our stomachs, they would have told us to listen to our food. I believe Weird Al Yankovic said it best when he said, no, he didn't, never did a parody of Listen to Our Heart. But Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful podcast, has tackled this very subject. So, Dan, you talk about food all the time.
Yes.
So it's talking about food. Talking, ears, mouth, food. And yet, up until this recent episode, you never really talked about the sound of food. Before you got into the science, were you big on the crinkliness or crunchiness of potato chips or the bag or other things associated with food?
Well, I certainly always have been someone who thinks a lot about texture, like crunch.
Yes. You know,
and so texture to me is a huge...
But how it feels in your mouth.
Well, that's what's so interesting about this is that you go in thinking that crunch, the experience of eating a crunchy food, is all about how it feels in your mouth. In reality, what I learned working on this episode and in doing some research is that actually a lot of what you think is the sense of feel,
yeah,
the texture, the crunch in your mouth is actually something you're perceiving with your other senses, and in the case of crunch, with your ears.
I guess we knew that smell greatly affects your sense of taste, and there are all these examples and experiments of people who don't have a sense of smell and lose a sense of taste, so it doesn't surprise us that the senses are correlated, but sound, that's weird.
I think it's the forgotten sense when it comes to eating. Obviously, you have taste and smell, even touch and texture, yeah, is part of it. Sight, obviously, the studies have shown that if presentation,
yes,
does matter, people perceive the food to taste better if it looks better. But sound does matter. So, for instance, there's a researcher named Charles Spence out of Oxford in the UK who he did this study where he had people eat potato chips. Mm-hmm. He used Pringles because they're identical.
So yes, they're uniform,
he
right.
He controlled for chip variation.
Right.
And he had people...
Oh, that one was an extra nookie cranny one, yes.
So he had people eat chips in front of a microphone while wearing headphones,
yeah,
that were connected to the microphone. And so they eat the chip and they hear the crunch in their headphones. Then he would mess with the sound, make it louder or quieter or more bass or more,
yeah,
you know, change the pitch. And what he found was that when people heard the crunch to be louder, they would rate the chips more highly. They perceived the chips to be crunchier, fresher, better.
Yeah.
Even though they were not, they were identical to the others.
What about when he changed it to make it seem as if the chips were screaming in agony upon being bitten?
Then people felt great amount of guilt.
Yeah. and what about the boing sound effect? Did they find a sensual attachment to the chips?
That's a sensual sound?
Yeah, and Howard Stern, they always did it to show that someone was becoming aroused. Boing.
I see. Yes. I guess I don't think of arousal on Howard Stern's show as,
yeah,
being sensual.
That's true. The sensual pleasure.
Usually feels more transactional,
you,
on,
yeah,
that show.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But yeah, so sound affects the eating experience in so many ways. Like, for instance, background music,
mm-hmm,
is a huge part of eating. Studies have shown that when the background music is very loud at a restaurant, you taste less. It's kind of similar, like, you know, when you're driving and you're driving down the highway, you're blasting the music, you're rocking out. And then you pull off the highway and you have to navigate,
yeah,
to where you're going.
These days I EDM out, but okay. Go on.
Yeah. I really need to see that at,
yeah,
some point soon.
Yeah, me and Skrillex.
Yeah. I see you got his haircut.
Yeah.
So you pull off the highway and you have to navigate and you turn the volume down.
Yeah.
Now, why? Because typically, like, you're only seeing to navigate. You shouldn't need it to be quieter, but it is distracting.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me think of that restaurant, Mission Chinese, this Danny Bowien restaurant. I think there's one in New York and one on the West Coast, and he's one of these trendy new chefs. And the food's known for being insanely spicy, and he's also known for playing really loud music. And I kind of feel like he could make the food less spicy if you just turn the damn volume down.
He puts the pow in the kung pow.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So background sounds matter, and that really affects the eating experience. And studies show that if you're at a French restaurant, you hear sort of what you perceive to be authentic, classic French music, you will say that the food is more authentic.
Yeah.
So there's even a famous chef in London named Heston Blumenthal, mm-hmm, who has this seafood dish. And when they serve it to you, they give you an iPod with headphones. And you put the headphones on, and you hear sounds of the ocean.
Okay. It might make the dish taste a little better.
Are you going to be skeptical, Mike?
I'm not skeptical. Just like, what kind of just persnickety fool must you be to actually have to listen to sounds of the ocean to taste your sea bream? Is it bream? Did we determine it was bream? I think it's bream. Yes, okay. I'm not. No, I see that it could work. I also see that if you, you know, watched a Viewmaster slide of the old man in the sea, that might evoke some nautical themes too. But no, I buy it. I believe it. And I probably think that chefs don't realize it. And people often complain about loud restaurants, but their complaint is that it hurts the overall experience. You're saying it actually hurts the flavor of the food.
Yes. And yeah. The same is true on airplanes. One of the reasons why taste sensation is reduced on airplanes is because there's such a high decibel level.
Oh, I would think so many, there's so many other things going on in airplanes to make taste less fun.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yes. Also because they keep the cabin so dry, it's a certain safety precaution that has to do with, I think, like the fuselage. Your nose and your mouth dry out, and that also reduces taste sensation.
All right. So we are going to do an experiment to highlight some of these phenomena.
Tell me
what I need to do.
So this is going to be a study about how background music can affect taste.
Okay.
And just listeners, you can do this at home. You can play along if you have dark chocolate or coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, black coffee or coffee that's been a little bit sweetened with milk or sugar.
Uh-huh.
But if you're one of these coffee
milk... Not sweetened, just a little milk.
Or a little sugar.
Okay. But
if you're one of these coffee milkshake types who wants, you know, a pound of sugar.
Light and sweet.
Right. Yeah. It won't work as well for you, but just listeners can follow along.
All right.
You know, Stephen Colbert listens to this show. He's a just listener.
Yeah, I've heard that. Yes.
Yeah. Stephen, do this at home.
Wait, before we do this, you've had to encounter this hosting the Sporkful for as many years as you had. What's your general sense of eating and slurping on the radio?
I think that in moderation, it is a useful sound effect to evoke an experience for the listener.
Some people just hate it so much. Nails on a chalkboard.
I get more complaints, and I don't eat much on the show, but on the rare occasions that I do, I will get an occasional complaint about the sound of chewing and mastication.
Yes, right.
People are more upset. Slurping, I think people accept, it feels more like a sound effect.
Okay, I get you. Yeah, no one wants to be inside someone's mouth.
So here's what we're going to do. We're going to learn a little bit about how background music can affect taste, and in particular, how it can affect how sweet or bitter something tastes. So first, I want you to take a sip of your coffee, and as you do, hold the coffee in your mouth a little bit and really think and register the levels of sweetness and bitterness and really kind of get a score in your mind of how sweet or bitter it is.
So like that restaurant, should I visualize the donkey that Juan Valdez rode in on?
If that helps you.
That would help. It usually does.
Really take a note of the sweetness and the bitterness.
Okay.
Got it? Okay. Now this next sip, I want you to take the sip and I want you to hold the coffee in your mouth.
Okay.
And at that moment, we're going to hear some music and I want you to pay attention to how the sweetness or bitterness may change. Here we go. What do you think?
I think got a little more bitter.
Okay.
That's what I think.
All right.
Tiny bit.
Okay, yeah. Number two ready? Can we make it a little louder?
Hold this, do it again, hold it in my mouth. I think it got sweeter.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And
is that the way it's supposed to go?
Yes. Higher pitched music makes it taste sweeter. And I found when I did the same experiment with dark.
The thing is, it was pretty weak coffee to begin with. I think if you start with something where the bitterness is more present, you could sense the change a little more.
Perhaps, yes. Yeah. I mean, the first time I did this, I did it with a very dark, dark chocolate. And the second that high-pitched music kicked in, it felt like my tongue had landed on a sugar crystal.
You know, it's funny. Maybe this works in politics because I was watching a Donald Trump rally. It was the C-SPAN video, and they just rolled tape for like an hour before he came, and I was listening to all the songs. And they're pretty aggressive songs that I don't think were really curated, songs like Sympathy for the Devil and Rolling Stones, but I think that kind of like bitter tone influenced the audience to be more bitter and to kick Obama out. I don't know. It's
that
crazy
could be.
Theory.
If he wins, that might have been it.
Yeah.
One more quick fact about this research is, you know, there is an actual purpose, hopefully, for society, which is that there's optimism that you could use some of these techniques to essentially alter the brain's perception of taste so that you can make food with less sugar.
Oh, that's
make
good.
Food with less salt.
Yeah.
And to supplement the loss in flavor with some of these tricks, essentially,
right,
to make your brain think it tastes sweeter.
Well, I've also thought about my kids who are pretty good eaters but are resistant to certain kinds of things. Maybe I could play certain kinds of music to heighten the associations. Softer, high-pitched music with the Brussels sprouts, for instance.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. This is the sound of Pashman. This is the sound of food. Dan Pashman is host of the Sporkful podcast, produced by WNYC, available where podcasts are available. Thank you, Dan.
Thanks, Mike.
And now the spiel, what's a vote worth? Now that all the results are officially in, we know who got how many votes in Iowa. And through the miracle of division, we know how much each candidate spent to get those votes. Let's do the numbers.
The Huffington Post did the math. Jeb Bush, he and his super PAC spent about $14 million in the Hawkeye State. He got 5,000 votes. Sixth place spent about $2,800 per vote.
Jeb Bush earned 5,238 votes in Iowa. He also earned a delegate, by the way. Carly Fiorina also earned a delegate. Not that hard to get a delegate out of Iowa, it turns out. Now, $2,800, and that math is a little fuzzy because how much did he only spend in Iowa? He's spending nationally. PACs on his behalf are spending. But it's at least $2,800. That is a significant amount. Let's put it this way. If one candidate were to say, if you elect me, you will get an extra $2,800, and no other candidate could say that, 90% of Americans would be a fool not to take the $2,800. $2,800 is significant to a vast majority of Americans. In America, the median income is $54,000. So $2,800 is a 5% raise, not bad, to the bottom quintile of Americans. So we're talking about 20% of Americans. They make $11,600 a year. So $2,800 is a full 25% raise. Now, here's where this gets complicated. The more people who like the deal, yeah, I'll take your $2,800, well, then that money gets divided up, so it's less money per voter, right? Think about winner Ted Cruz. How much did he spend? Well, let's do the numbers.
To GOP winner Ted Cruz, about $250 per.
And remember, that $250 per person includes the misleading tweet about Ben Carson dropping out, which cost him nothing. Okay, but let's now talk about the cost of a presidential election. The website opensecrets.org reports that the last presidential election year, 2012, elections spent $6 billion. More was spent on congressional and Senate races than the presidency, but the cost of the presidential election alone, they said, was calculated to be about $2.6 billion. The estimate for 2016 that you see floating around, and it's a rough estimate, but it seems plausible, is a $5 billion election. Now, $5 billion sounds like a lot of money, right? We say, that's billion with a B. It's one of the few words that we don't think people know how to hear unless we use that phrase. That's murder with an M. Really? He didn't murder him? No, he murder with an M'd him. Anyway, billion with a B is a lot of money if you or I had it. Even if Trump had it. Not if Bloomberg had it. Anyway, we're a country of about a third of a billion people. So $5 billion divided by 300-something million people, talking about $15 per American. That's not that much. But hold on. Not every American votes. Last time, only about 130 million people voted. The presidential election before that, where everyone is excited about Barack Obama, 131 million. The one before that, 122 million. So more people are born every year than die. The population goes up. I don't know how exciting the 2016 election will be, but let's use a number around the highest number ever, 131 million. All right. It comes out to about $38 a voter. But wait a minute. You don't need the vote of every voter to win. You need the vote of half the voters. So we're talking about $75 a voter. Now, at this point, you're saying to me, wait a minute, you're taking all the money spent on all the presidential elections, and you're only counting the money you need to win. Well, here's how I think about it. Think about a game of poker. You and I are playing, and I push $100 in the middle, and you push $100 in the middle. And then in the next round, I push $200 in, and you fold. Well, I get to keep all your money. I think for our purposes, you could calculate all the money spent on a presidential election because it's a zero-sum game. All the money spent on anyone who lost, there's no value at all for that money. So I'm going to use the calculation of all the money spent divided by how many people it takes to win an election. But it doesn't take half the popular vote to win an election. As a matter of fact, you can, because of the Electoral College, win an election winning only certain states. You could win the presidency if you won the following states: California, Texas, New York, Pennsylvania, Florida, Illinois, Ohio, Virginia, North Carolina, Georgia, New Jersey, and Washington. That's 12 out of 50 states. In fact, you'd be well over the 270 electoral votes you need to win the election. Did the math. About 72 million people voted in those states. So that means you need the votes of about 36 million people to win the election. Hold on, that's not even true. Because you'd be better off buying the votes in the very small states that have at least three electoral votes. Here's how I figured the math. Wyoming has three electoral votes. A quarter of a million people voted in the last Wyoming election. So that winds up being 0.00012 electoral votes per voter. Washington has 12 electoral votes, 3 million voters. If you do the math, it's 0.00004 electoral votes per voter. In other words, every voter in Wyoming has three times the impact on the Electoral College that every voter in Washington has. Different states will have different turnouts, but still, if you first buy up all the small states and then strategically buy half the voters in the other big states, you can win the presidential election if the exact right, I'm going to say about 25 million people vote for you. Now, when you do the math, the $5 billion spent on the election to really get the votes of the right 25 million people, it winds up being $200 a vote. And this, I submit, is not insignificant. Sure, Ted Cruz spent $250 in Iowa. But if you went to every American and said to you, not going to campaign, not going to send a mailer, not going to fly around, all I'm going to do is pay you when you've spent $200 on me, I think you could win the election. I mean, $200 might not seem a lot, but remember the stimulus? It was all up in arms that the stimulus would pay $600 a person. It was a huge political calculation. And the next year when they did stimulus too, they bumped it down to $400 a person, families receiving $800. But still, it was a huge calculation. I think $200 a person would influence a lot of people. In fact, you could only make the offer to first the lowest quartile and then the next lowest quartile, where $200 goes really far. I think this is the better way to win the election than to fly all around the country and raise a lot of money and buy a plane, or if you have a plane, even gas up the plane. It sounds crazy, but is it crazier than Donald Trump's candidacy? I think we're saying, yes, we can. And that's it for today's show. Just producer Andrea Salenzi's vote is worth at least $283. Executive producer of Slate Podcast Steve Lickteig drilled for a wildebeest escape, but found out the zoo he was working in didn't have wildebeests, just a cadre of wildebeest furries who cavorted under the moon. Andy Bowers, chief content officer of the Panoply Network, has a similar story, but he found out he didn't even work in a zoo. The drill he was part of was just being filmed for a Japanese game show called Moose on the Loose. The gist, bribing impressionable Idahoans $1 at a time. Umperu depuru du peru, and thanks for listening.